This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. This week, a panel discussion on mass incarceration and higher education. Between 1972 and 2018, the U.S. prison population grew from about 200,000 to over 2.2 million people, a shift of 0.1% to over 0.5% of the total U.S. population. In Utah, in spite of recent reforms made to sentencing and an overall drop in the rates of property and violent crimes, the prison population has continued to expand. Between 2016 and 2017, Utah's had one of the nation's fastest-growing prison populations, jumping by 4.3%, second only to Idaho's 5.1%. With more prisoners, the question of rehabilitation and recidivism has taken on greater importance in state and national policy discussions. The panel looks at the causes of these trends and how education might be used to prevent future incarceration. This forum was held in partnership with SAMI, Students Against Mass Incarceration, and UPEP, University of Utah Prison Education Project, and was recorded on March 27, 2019. The forum was moderated by Laura Jones and Billy Palmer, hosts of the Radioactive program on KRCL. The panelists were Utah Representative Sandra Hollins, Cindy Fierros, co-director of UPEP, and Chuck Williams, SLCC Prison Education Alumni Coordinator.
Good afternoon. My name is Cindy Fierros. I am a faculty member here in Gender Studies. I am also the co-director of the University of Utah Prison Education Project. We are a project founded by your fellow honors students and staff members here at the University of Utah. So I think that's first and foremost something really important to know about that. We are a program that offers on-site college courses, non-credit college courses to incarcerated individuals down in Draper Prison. We are in two facilities, Wasatch, which is a men's facility, and Timpanogos, which is a women's facility. And so we offer one course a semester. We run the academic schedule that the U is on, and we offer a variety of courses. We also have an admissions process that our students apply for. So potential applicants down in the Draper facilities apply to be on our program. And we have a wonderful team of admissions readers who are made up of University of Utah faculty and advanced grad students and community members.
Hello, I am Utah State Representative Sandra Hollins. I represent District 23, which is the northwest side of Salt Lake City. So if any of you all live in the Rose Park, Fair Park area, then I will be your representative. I wear two different hats. I'm a state representative and serve on the Criminal Justice and Law Enforcement Committee. That's one of my assignments up at the Hill. And so I have an interest in what is going on in our prison system and in general in the criminal justice system. But also I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I've been a social worker for over 10 years. I received my master's degree from right here at the U. And my primary focus has been on those in poverty and those who are homeless. And I've worked in different capacities. I've been everything from a mental health therapist. I've been a case manager. I've been a housing case manager. And I worked as the director of outreach. Currently, I'm working for the city. I'm a homeless strategist and outreach coordinator. And so my interest is a lot of my clients and individuals that I've worked with, I find that they have a background of being incarcerated. And so I've worked with trying to help them apply for jobs, and I've worked with them trying to get them into housing and trying to helping them assimilate back into the community. And so that's been my primary interest in this population, and how do we get them back into the community and back to working again. So that's pretty much my background.
My name's Chuck Williams. I'm the coordinator of Salt Lake Community College's prison program. Currently, we have 13 classes going in three different facilities, and these are 4-credit classes. We're trying to get them ready for the U. My interest in this is that I'm an ex-convict who got his degree in prison. They stopped doing college probably 15 years ago. So, and just now, in the last couple of years, Salt Lake Community College has been able to get a foothold, and along with UPEP. So we're hoping to expand it and grow it. And I can just say that going to college and prison changed my life. And so that's why I actively encourage inmates out there, some of whom I know, I've been out for about 10 years, to take up college, because it can make that kind of difference in your life.
All right.
So thank you for that. So we're talking about the politics of prisons here, is the subject. And I'm just going to give you some statistics here. 1972, the U.S. population was 209 million people, just over, and the U.S. prison population was around 200,000 people. And so the populace was about 0.1% of our populace was in prison at the time. Coming around to 2018, the statistics show that we have 372 million people, and the prison population has ballooned to 2.2%, 2.2 million people in prison now. So that ballooning of our prison population between 1972 and now, is there a way that we can get into that conversation, and who wants to start? What are your comments about that ballooning, and what are your views on how it happened?
I think some of it, we could see the mass incarceration of people, and particularly people of color, during a lot of that time when we declared war on drugs. I think a lot of the that population went up during that time, and when we started incarcerating people for nonviolent and minor offenses. We saw a big balloon in that population during that time. And I think that right now we're in a time where we are seeing, as in the state of Utah, a conversation and policy that is now going on around reinvestment. Is it called reinvestment? I'm sorry. Where we're looking at how we sentence people and how we are arresting people and why we are arresting people into the criminal justice system. But I still think it's high. It's way too high nationally. What's going on? And like I said, and particularly with communities of color and how a lot of the focus, how our criminal justice system is set up in a way where there's systematic racism going on. And not only with people of color, but when you look at people who are in poverty or people who are poor, they get caught up in the system also, because, you know, if you can't hire the best attorneys to defend you, or you don't have that economic advantage, you find yourself caught up in this system.
Chuck, did you have some thoughts? Especially kind of interested in your point of view, coming from having been a felon.
Yes, so I was a California prisoner. I committed my crime in California in 1978. During the 70s, there were a couple big riots in the United States, in Attica, George Jackson, to San Quentin. These kind of things kind of led to a rehabilitation ethic, and a lot of people saying we need to do good things in our prisons and give people opportunities. But then in the 80s, that had quite a backlash. And all you ever heard about from every politician, it seemed like, was an anti-crime platform. I know in California, a guy who was running for insurance commissioner actually ran on his conviction record as a prosecutor. So, because crime's a very emotional issue and it gets people fired up. So once that backlash started, California, there was 11 prisons when I got into the system in 78, and then there was about 30 when I left in 1998. And hopefully now the pendulum's gonna start to swing back a little, because it's gone just way too far. There's way too many people locked up.
Mm-hmm. You both mentioned rehabilitation, and it seems somewhat of a misnomer when we look at the recidivism rate in prisons. We're not rehabbing people. What in the state are we doing from your perspective, Sandra Hollins, and love for you to chime in as well, but what in the state are we doing for, in a sense, restorative justice that allows for people to actually rehabilitate and not get people out of that cycle of in and out of prison constantly?
You know, I think one of the biggest things that we're starting to look at is we're starting to focus on mental health care. I think that's a huge part of keeping people out of that system. Unfortunately, we have seen a lot of individuals who are caught up in the system, and prisons have become a default for mental health facilities. And people are in that system who should not be in that system because of their mental health. So I think that's one of the things we're looking at. And another thing is one of the bills that I ran, 2015, I think, I did ban the box bill. So we can look at how do we get people back into the workforce. We know that the studies have shown that when individuals are able to work and able to contribute, because you will find most people want to contribute, they want to work, and they want to get out of that system. And so that was one of the things that I looked at doing and trying to get people back in the workforce. And I've had this conversation with some of my colleagues. I said, look, we have a choice. If people are not able to participate legally in the economy, they're going to participate illegally in the economy. So we need to assure that individuals are able to be in the workforce because they want to be productive. And I want to say I ran that bill because I did have a constituent who came to me and said to me, look, I have this background. I've been incarcerated, but I am married, and I want to be able to support my wife, and I want to be able to support my kids. And I was wondering if there's anything you can do. And so when I started researching, I saw Ban the Box. Unfortunately, it does not apply to the private sector. I would love for it to apply for a private sector.
Can you describe Ban the Box just a little bit for people?
Sure. What Ban the Box is, it says that when you apply in the state of Utah for a state job, that they cannot ask you up front whether you have a criminal background. Once you get in that interview, they are able to have that conversation with you, and that gives a person a chance to have that discussion. That gives a person a chance to discuss what they've been doing and how they've been rehabilitating themselves since being out of the criminal system.
She mentioned mental illness. That's something you are familiar with yourself, Cindy. What are your comments?
Well, I want to say, come back to your first question, because I do think it is related to rehabilitation efforts, is that a large part of the increase of the incarcerated population is a disinvestment in particular communities, structural disinvestment, if we're talking about individuals with mental illness, individuals with undocumented status, queer community, poor communities of color. So there's been a disinvestment from educational services and support services that would minimize crime, aside from also just an increase in harsher sentencing as well. So rehabilitation efforts are super important, but it's also really important to invest in these communities as vulnerable populations, right? So that we're not having people incarcerated. In terms of rehabilitation efforts, I think education, I am the co-director of the Prison Education Project, I think education is really important. And so the fact that Salt Lake Community College is being supported by some state funding is a very optimistic sign. And so I think that there needs to be more investment to incarcerated individuals in terms of education, but I think that also needs to translate to reentry efforts as well. So the Ban the Box is really important for employment, and I think Beyond the Box or the Ban the Box movement, and also is really important for college admissions as well. The Common Application has removed the question about prior incarceration for college applications, but it is up to institutions then to decide if they want to ask it as a supplemental question. And so I think because of the many barriers that question produces for individuals who want to apply to college or to jobs. I think that the Ban the Box movement in terms of rehabilitative efforts needs to be expanded to other institutions as well.
Fantastic. Chuck, we're talking the big F word felony, being able to get a job after getting out of prison, gaining an education system. You, a person that got your education in prison, up against a tough against crime ethos that the country seems to have, you know, jumped onto. I mean, I think it's pretty normal for folks to say we should be tough on crime. It's pretty normal for folks to say, why should we give prisoners a free education? Why should we benefit folks that commit crimes and give them free educations when they go to prison? What do you have to say to things in that framework?
Well, for one thing, the education isn't free. They pay a discounted rate, but it's not free. I would like to say opportunity is important. A person needs to have an opportunity. When they made their mind up to change their life, when they really, you know, take that hard look at themselves and see that they need to change, then there has to be opportunities ready for, available to them. One thing I like about our program and UPEP is that they're voluntary. Now, they have rehabilitation programs in the prison that are not voluntary. The inmates are forced to take them. And so there's a little bit of resentment for those guys that have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, or those guys that have to go to Thinking for a Change. A lot of it's just behavioral psychology stuff. But they don't like being told that they have to. So we get really the cream of the crop, and that the people that come to our program and UPEP are people that want to change, that they're making that choice themselves. They're not being forced into it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important.
And you went into prison in a population of folks that committed crimes. Nowadays, we have folks that, you know, three strikes and you're out. For small offenses, could be drug possession of just having marijuana in your pocket. So things have changed quite a bit.
And for sure.
When I said normal, I didn't mean that's actually normal. I just meant that we have normalized the tough on crime policy.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today we are airing a panel on mass incarceration and higher education, held on March 27, 2019. Picking up where we left off, here is moderator Billy Palmer.
Is there any questions out there? Please start raising your hands. We would be happy to come around. We have one question right here.
So this is for Representative Hollins. Is there any potential that the state legislator could be could be moving towards decriminalizing like drugs, or is that something we're going to have to wait from the federal level?
I think that's something that we're probably going to have to wait for from the federal level. I don't see my colleagues decriminalizing drugs. I mean, you all just remember what happened with just the medical marijuana. I mean, come on.
That was for medical.
And so I don't see any policies or anyone introducing any policies in the near future that's going to decriminalize drugs.
Billy, over here.
Over here? Okay.
Ernie Rogers, Utah Prisoner Advocate Network. As I understand it, the Justice Reinvestment Initiative started by the governor was started about 4 years ago. The facts are that today there are more people in the prison than there were when the initiative started. Back at that time, the recidivism rate was about 67%. Latest information I have is it's still at 67%. The education programs they use in the prison do not work. 85% of the people that take the drug program in the prison go back again. So what we need is a better education in the prison system. And I think a college education, it will help people find jobs and stay out. How do we get education to be less expensive for everyone? I have this suggestion. There are a lot of smart people in the prison. There are some former University of Utah professors in the prison. Why not put them to work helping to teach some classes?
Okay. And that is a model that some, because of lack of sources, that some incarcerated students have taken up on their own. You're absolutely right. I know down Gunnison, the students create their own curriculum down there. They have a coding curriculum. They have all kinds of curriculum. They are creating it themselves. They share it with each other. They share it with other facilities as well. And I do think that it is important, this conversation about why should we pay for individuals who have committed a crime. Prior to 1904, Pell Grants were available to incarcerated students. You should know that less than 1% of what was available for Pell Grants was actually going to incarcerated students. And what was going was really successful. The Obama administration piloted the Second Chance pilot program, where they were offering Pell Grants to certain sites, certain schools, and the kind of initial data coming out of there that those have been really successful with students receiving certificates and associates, whether they're completing those on the inside or the outside. So that certainly is one model that is happening at sites in terms of using the resources that are inside. But I think overall there needs to be both local, state, and federal commitment to providing accessible, affordable education, quality higher education to incarcerated students, because it is also scary that there are a lot of for-profit institutions who make their way into facilities, and folks on the inside want education, and so they put up a lot of money to receive degrees and credits from for-profit educations, and we need to be pretty critical of those.
Any comments from the rest of the panel?
Before you ask your question, can I get a raise of hands on who all here are students? Okay, hands down, please. Okay, how many of you folks are going to go into a field of like journalism, criminal justice, public administration? Just hands up. Okay. All right. So before we ask that question, can we get to addressing some of the folks in the room who are students on what possibly can they do to sort of help with criminal justice? You spoke about your colleagues and what we see happening on the Hill, what's possible. How can this younger generation get involved with creating change and ending the prison issues that we see now?
Sure. You know, as a representative, I always encourage individuals to stay in contact with your senators and your representatives. Let them know who you are. Before I ran for office, my representative knew me quite well. She knew me so well that when she decided to retire, she called me and asked me if I wanted to run for a position, because I would call her so much about what was going on in my community and what I was concerned about. So I would encourage you to learn to advocate for yourself. And I want to say this, you know, because after this last election, I had a number of people, and particularly students, who came to me and said, well, look, our vote didn't count, and we got out there and we fought, and then we lost the battle, and this happened. Yes, but just because you lose a battle, don't give up the fight of the war. Please stay out there. Please stay advocating. Start advocating. Stay out front, talking to your policymakers, letting them know what you're seeing and some policy changes that you would like to see in this state. And let them know who you are. You have to come up to the Hill. I tell everybody that everybody is called the people's house, but everybody's in the house but the people, the actual people, the voters who elected us to do our job. We need you all up there. I need you all in those committees. I'm on criminal justice and law enforcement. When we're in those committees and we're talking policies, you can sign up to talk, and you should sign up to talk and let them know what your opinion is and what you're seeing and giving feedback to us. And so that's very important. Get involved. Get involved. Find out where you fit. It may be running for office. It may be making phone calls. It may be in a grassroots effort. But find out exactly where you fit in the process and then work that.
I would like to add, too, that this our sponsors here is a great place to start with the Students Against Mass Incarceration. So if you're being active now, you know, don't forget when you get out of school to stay active. And I think I see already millennials and the later generations way more positive than the current people
call themselves. They're a lot smarter than us, too, so.
Question right here. This is a question for you, Representative Hollins. So Representative Ellison ran a homeless resource center drug-free zone bill that ultimately failed. And I noticed that your vote on it in the House was the only dissenting vote. Can you talk a little bit about what brought you to that decision to vote against the bill and how that fits into the conversation about incarceration in the U.S.?
Sure, and I thought that policy passed. It failed in the Senate?
In Senate Health and Human Services, okay. It failed.
I had a concern about that piece of policy because I have a concern about when you start criminalizing individuals who use drugs and around that center, around the homeless shelters. And so do I think that there needs to, be law enforcement involved in some type of way? Yeah, especially for those individuals who are preying on that population. And those who are connected to the bigger drug deals. But do I think we need to criminalize those individuals who get caught up in that system, who are addicted? No, I don't think we should. And that was my concern about that piece of policy, is that we were going to criminalize those individuals who are homeless, who are living on the streets, and making it tougher for them to be able to find jobs and find homes and to move forward. So I was the only dissenting vote, and I stood my ground on it.
Well, I'd like to add, too, that that was doomed to fail in society. If you guys are students, so go back and remember Psych 101 and Maslow. There's a hierarchy of needs. So you have to have food, you have to have shelter, you have to have clothing. Once you have those things, then you can start working on some of your dynamics. But I mean, just to survive, you have to have basic things: housing, food.
Hi, I'm Erin Castro. I want to first thank Representative Hollins. 3 years ago, you wrote us a letter of support when UPEP started, and I haven't been able to publicly thank you for that. So thank
you.
that helped us get a lot of momentum in the early stages. The question I have goes back to your Ban the Box initiatives. The University of Utah is moving to the Common App next year, and right now we are... asking applicants about prior criminal history, and it will be required next year from what I understand. It is currently optional. USU also requires it, Westminster requires it, and we've just gotten word that UVU is not gonna add it. Do you see any optimism here that we could add institutions of higher education to the efforts in the state around banning the box if we think about the importance of higher education as reentry?
You know, it's something I'm willing to consider and willing to look at. I had not thought about it because a lot of times I like to have those conversations first and ask people if that's something that they're willing to do. And I just kind of think legislation and policy needs to be the last push. If you have individuals who don't see that this will be to their advantage. So it's something that I'm willing to have conversation with universities about their policies around it, because we know it's going to have a negative impact on those individuals with criminal backgrounds. And I think we need to be pushing at the universities policies that's going to embrace the community. You are a part of the community, so we need to embrace the community and including those individuals who may be formerly incarcerated.
Can I follow up with that? As far as ban the box, as a Utah policy, our universities, many of them, University of Utah, UVU, how is it that they can put the box, on if we've passed that we cannot ban the box, that we have to ban the box?
It's for employees.
For employees only. So,
she's referring to the student application. Yeah. And so,
Thank you. Next question.
Yes, I'm Nalini Nadkarni from the School of Biological Sciences here at the University of Utah. I'm a faculty member here, and some of my staff and students are here also. And I guess my question is about, relates to what you said, Sandra, about students finding their place, students finding a way to help. And I just wanted to kind of address or bring up the question of the diversity of ways that we can do this, that some of you are doing some really wonderful work with getting formal education and credit-bearing classes. But I also wanted to let you know that we have a program in the Biological Sciences School called INSPIRE, the initiative to bring science education and science programs to the incarcerated. We have a monthly science lecture series at the Draper State Prison, at the Salt Lake County Jail, and we've been recently working with 6 juvenile detention centers. And we very informally bring a faculty member or a graduate student, and sometimes undergraduate students, to give a lecture about their own research, their discipline of science, to the prison, to the jail, or to these detention centers, to bring the presence of a scientist, to show that scientists really do care about populations outside of the university bubble. So we would just extend this. This is not credit-bearing, but we feel that it helps not only provide science knowledge content, but also perhaps helps shift the self-identity of people who have had usually very poor science education background or a negative attitude about their own ability to learn science, to realize that, oh, well, I am a science learner. I understood everything that professor said. So we also have some conservation projects that are ongoing at the Salt Lake Community College, Salt Lake County Jail, and at the juvenile detention centers. So if any students are interested in that, please contact us at the biology department. And also, a question I guess I do have is, how can we integrate this program, which has been kind of isolated from the other really great work that's going on here at the university and at Salt Lake Community College, so that our program might do a better job of providing alternative ways of bringing education, especially science education, to the incarcerated?
Well, I will say that just a few weeks ago, a few of us in the room attended the first ever convening of educators who provide any type of educational programming to incarcerated individuals in the state of Utah. So that was really exciting that is the first, a little sad that was the first time, but also exciting that happened. So I do think that there is a real commitment, an understanding that quality education is really important for folks who are incarcerated. The majority of folks who are incarcerated for the first time without a high school diploma or GED. So there's already this disinvestment in certain populations in terms of education. So I think one is having these convenings where folks who are committed to providing education to incarcerated individuals are talking. And then I will say about the participation, it's interesting that at the same time that the U will be moving to the common application, will be requiring this question about prior incarceration, we also have at the same time this new task force, and I'm going to forget the name, Student Success Initiative, that really is focusing on creating this university that is for Utah. And we have to remember that folks who are incarcerated in our state prisons are part of the Utah community. And so it's a really good time to hold our school administration accountable to this new task force and to encourage them and challenge them on how adding the question about prior incarceration actually runs counter to this new initiative that they are highlighting.
Representative Hollins, it sounds like you have another bill to...
I was looking for
over here.
I heard my name, okay.
Come on, you know the voice. So it sounds like you might have another initiative to expand the Ban the Box to state-owned institutions of higher learning in the application process. Is that something that might be in the back of your mind now?
It is in the back of my mind, and I'll add it to the long list of other stuff that I'm that I'm working at and looking at this summer for possibly for next year.
That's Utah Representative Sandra Hollins speaking at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on March 27th. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma.
Hello, my name is Ginger Phillips, and actually I was the peer support specialist trainer for 7 years in the state of Utah. I trained over 700 peer specialists. The gentleman who was in prison in California, I'm really glad to hear someone's lived experience. I have known the peer specialists who've been in recovery even for like 7 years, and they've been in and out of prison or in and out of the state hospital. Mainly the ones with the background cannot get jobs. So I'm really glad that we're trying to get this focused on. Even like the expungement process is literally like ridiculous, and it takes so long. And there's these peers who are waiting. I want to go be a peer specialist in these places with mental illness or a recovery for substance abuse. So my question is, going back to mental illness, because it seems like the focus, there's been a huge focus on the opioid epidemic, and it seems like mental illness is kind of getting lost again. So my question is, with the evidence-based practice of peer support, have you ever considered using peer bridgers, which will make like the recidivism rate from 85% to 17%? And this is evidence-based. It's been proven nationally. Optum Health is even one who has been someone keeping statistics. And there's also a 70% reduction in hospitalizations. The other thing is the Utah State Hospital, their forensic unit is packed. And I know they had a lawsuit trying to get more people in there. But like you suggested, yeah, that the prisons and jails have become our, you know, mental health units. So if you could please address that and see if anything could come up about peer support.
Isn't that sort of what I'm doing as an ex-convict who's helping convicts? And I think you're going to see more and more of that. Already Utah is allowing ex-users and addicts to facilitate at some of the, like, Odyssey and the different places like that. So I think you will see more of it.
Are any of you familiar with peer support?
I am familiar with peer support. When I worked as a director of outreach services, I've hired peer support specialists before, peer specialists to work with the those experienced homeless, because I find that they are able to bring a perspective that I cannot bring to the table. So I've actually hired individuals. And in fact, I have a young lady that I've worked with who's in the community, Rachel, who is awesome. And there have been times I have been stuck trying to figure something out, something that's going on with the camps on the street. And I will call her and say, hey, this is what's going on. Tell me what you think, or tell me what you think the best approach is, or can you go out and talk to these individuals and give your perspective to them to see if we can kind of get the needle moving on moving them forward in life. And so, yes, I think peer specialists bring something to the table that those of us who have not experienced that can bring to the table. And I think that we underutilize them in the mental health field, and we should be.
I have a daughter incarcerated in Timpanogos, and she's taking the classes. And she sends me the certificates that she receives. She's taking microbiology now, and we're so proud of her. Everything that everybody's touched upon is right on spot. We really need the community involved. Matter of fact, the school to prison pipelines meeting Saturday, it starts from when they're little. My daughter's been traumatized, and it just escalated to the point of addiction to meth, and then next thing you know, a life was taken. But she lost her son, her fiance, and her stepdad all within a few years' time. And it's just there's just no place for her to go. She didn't have insurance. The thing is, we need all of us, from the college down to the advocates, two legislators all working together, because it's our people. You know, I have a long story. Trauma, generational trauma. I don't even know where to start. Where did it start? You know, who knows? It's just been like my grandpa committed suicide. So it's just, there's so much work. So I just commend everybody that's here on board to work, advocate, serve your fellow in the spirit of servitude. I appreciate everything that we're all doing together. And I just thank everybody that's moving in the right direction. Yeah.
She mentioned something fairly important there. Trauma. Yes. Trauma is a big part of our prison system and recidivism. It's a traumatic thing to lose your personage and be put into prison. SB 239, I believe, from a couple years ago, the restorative justice bill. Do we know? I'll just not ask the question. It was legislation a couple years ago, the restorative justice bill that got pushed through, the big bill with lots of money. You recall that?
Representative Snow, I think that was.
Yeah, I believe so. I know that a lot of those decision makings are still in committee, figuring out how we go about a restorative justice system. Do you know how much of that is being addressed as far as trauma and mental health?
You know, I am not sure as far as in the prison system how restorative justice is being addressed. So I cannot answer that question. But I know that a couple of years ago, former Representative Ray and I had a conversation around trauma and childhood trauma and how it plays out in adults. And so him and I started that discussion, and in fact, we showed a documentary up at the Capitol to some of my colleagues around childhood trauma and ACEs, and trying to encourage, and he ran a piece of legislation encouraging looking at ACEs in our school system and childhood trauma in our school system. And so it plays a big role in it. Trauma plays a really big role. Unresolved trauma plays a very big role in for us as adults.
Over there.
I just had a question for really the whole panel. In terms of resources provided to support the students while they are pursuing higher education opportunities, are they substantial? What are they? And also, what are we providing to them as a university while doing so? Do they have full access to advisors like our normal students do? Do we have specialty advisors? Just sort of what are we providing to them? What might we be able to provide to them? And how would that be created or conceived?
So the students who are in the UPEP program. So as Chuck mentioned, we are 100% volunteer-based. Another really important thing to know is, as I mentioned earlier, right now the students are taking classes, but they are not for credit. And the main reason is that we need money to pay tuition. And so we right now do not have any commitment from the University of Utah to offer support to pay for that tuition. So what we offer them right now are non-credit college courses. They are the exact same courses that you would take here. So you mentioned microbiology. If anybody's ever taken microbiology with Dr. Dustin Williams, they had that same course on the inside this summer. So we offer the class, and then we also offer another section of like what would be a section or a discussion out here. And so they have additional academic support specialists. We've also have worked with some of the academic advisors and the transfer advisors, and they've gone out and done a presentation for them as well. We're also, you can imagine, there is no internet on the inside. And so we are working with our library to be able to get them access to some of the resources without having to go online. We did just get 40 new computers, 20 in each facility on the inside. And so that is humongous. And so there, so yes, we work with all the different types of resources that are on campus and do our best to take those on the inside. But because right now they are non-credit, non-tuition, there are some barriers there.
We have time for one last question, so.
Thank you. So I think, you know, I think it's important to remember that, like, when talking about prison and education in prison programs, that we're not reinventing the wheel here. There are several great models of college and prison programs that have worked successfully. They're volunteer run, but they've, you know, successfully lobbied their policymakers and also received support from their university to be for credit and for the tuition to be paid for, like St. Louis University Prison Project. And so I was wondering if you could, you know, provide any insight onto how these programs became successful and what we can do to model those efforts and learn from them.
Yeah, a lot of the programs that remained after the Pell Grant was taken away, so in 1994 when the Pell Grant was taken away, a lot of the programs that survived were able to do so because they had been pretty stable already, and also through a lot of kind of private donations and grants. But what you see now is you do a lot of also the programs that are able to offer tuition, you see university support. So institutional support from administrators and an entire university to be able to sustain projects, yeah, which is not yet something that we have had as from our institution as a whole, yeah.
I think, too, that you have to have support from the community first before you can get volunteers to go in. They come from their community, so you have to have, like we're having a community discussion. I know that at San Quentin, they have a really good program. They have like 100 volunteers, all from the Bay Area, all believe very much in what they're doing. And so, yeah, that's one place to start, in the community.
Do you have any comments? Okay. All right, well, we thank you all for coming. I will ask one more question here, and that is going to be next steps, but I want to make sure that we thank the Students Against Mass Incarceration for hosting this. So my one last question is, as we leave this room, what do you think is the most important thing that all of us could do to help end mass incarceration and help get folks into higher education who have dealt with incarceration?
Well, I will say on the higher education front, in questioning about how you can get involved, I would really encourage you to voice your thoughts on the question regarding prior criminalization for potential student applicants. There is no research to support that asking that question makes our campuses safer. The question just instead prohibits a lot of very intelligent potential students from being on our campus. Two-thirds of applicants who are asked that question will end up not completing the rest of the application. And that disproportionately affects communities of color in the same ways that the large mass incarceration disproportionately affects communities of color. So I think that because we're at such a pivotal point here at the University of Utah with that question, I would encourage folks to think about how they can get involved with that.
And as I stated earlier, I'm going to encourage everyone to stay involved politically and know what's going on. criminal justice committees on both the Senate and the House side. I would go online to the Utah State Legislative website and look and see what policies are coming up and who's going to be presenting and what days they're going to be presenting and just kind of follow what's going on. Knowledge is power. Follow what's going on and just kind of see how these policies are going to affect the communities in which you represent.
So there's been some numbers thrown around, and I'm surprised that we haven't gotten to this. I've heard for maybe 20 years that Utah's recidivism rate was about 70%. For people that go to college in prison, it drops dramatically for every single year. If you've had 1 year of college, it's down to like under 20%. If you've had 2 years of college, it goes down to like 10%. I don't know the exact numbers, but that's a selling point. I mean, you can write letters to the editor of the newspapers. Just get that information out there. If you want to cut back recidivism, let people go to college.
All right, thank you to the panel. Representative Sandra Holland.
Today's panel was recorded on March 27th, 2019. If you missed some of the program or would like to hear a few more minutes, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour podcast. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, producer and host of this program. Thanks for listening.